Good evening. My name is Perry Hoffman. I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, and we want to welcome you to this special call-in tonight that's going to focus on the tragedy that happened in Connecticut last week. We're honored to have many professionals on the call who will be starting out and giving some little bit of their impressions or perspectives on some of this, and we invite callers to send in any questions that they may have to neabpd@aol.com. Please include your phone number and the question you'd like to ask. Your phone number will allow me to unmute you to ask your own question. It's now my privilege to turn over the call in to Dr. John Oldham, and we want to thank all our professionals who are so graciously giving of their time tonight. John?
Thanks, Perry, and Jim Breeding is on as well from NIMH, and the third person is Dr. John Allen, who is a senior psychologist at the Menninger Clinic. And my job is chief of staff at the Menninger Clinic and on the faculty. Both John and I are on the faculty at Baylor College of Medicine. And I hope we'll be joined shortly by Dr. Elizabeth Newland, who is the psychiatry medical director and program director of our adolescent treatment program at the Menninger Clinic. So I think she will be able to join us at some point. We, Perry and Jim and I, were talking about this just a few days ago when we were doing a program and call-in, and some of you may have been listening to that one, where we were talking about DSM-5 and personality disorders, and that was a PowerPoint presentation, which is often, I think, what these calls are formatted around. And we thought, given the immediacy and the enormous preoccupation we all have with this terrible tragedy that we're all dealing with in Connecticut, that rather than try to squeeze in a little time on that program to talk about it, we would try something new, which is just to have an open dialogue discussion about it and see if there are questions that we could help think about that people have. I know that this is something I've brought up at the Menninger Clinic with our staff and also with our patients, because it's something that everyone is preoccupied with. I think there's virtually no exception to that, because everyone has people they know where they have been touched in some way by trauma or have been in an existing situation, and certainly families with children. This is an enormous source of concern. So we're just going to see if this is something people find helpful and useful. And I thought I would start with just a few comments and then ask John to make some of his own as well. And Jim, at any time, if you want to add your thoughts, and we'll see if Liz joins us. We might also have one other faculty member, actually from UCLA in California, Dr. Anand Pandya, may join us in the last part of the call. He's an expert on just major disasters and how they affect people and how they cope with them. I guess I would start by just saying, with regard to this tragic situation, that one of the things that has been most, compelling to me has been how much misinformation there is that has been distributed by the media. Ostensibly responsible network media stations have extensively reported on this case, but along the way, things are reported as if they are established fact, and it turns out they're totally wrong. And that seems to be a continuing, changing picture. And I mention that as my first comment, because although we're all just enormously devastated to think about this, and this particular school situation is just, I think, one of the most horrific to all of us because of the young children who were involved. But it's really important not to assume that everything one hears about it has been confirmed and established, since there's just so little that's known. So I guess what I'm going to emphasize right off the bat is we need to understand this as deeply as we can and learn from it, but we need also to not prematurely assume that second and third-hand information is accurate. This also involves a situation that, in my own opinion, and here I'm going to include some things that are de facto based on the literature as well as some of my own personal opinion. I was in New York and watched 9/11 live from my office window, and at the time was the chief medical officer of the New York State Office of Mental Health. So that's a time when I really was in a very enormous disaster that also has affected this whole country. And among the things that happened were these same phenomena of massive anxieties and fears and exaggerations of what were thought to be facts that later turned out not to be. There were also phenomena that were called like trauma tourists, where people would come to New York just to go and see the site when it was still at the same time unapproachable and very close to the actual event. I guess I was I'm not at all happy about the degree to which our media cover scenes like this, and was pretty horrified myself to see these upfront interviews of these very young children with the bright lights on them, asking them to talk about it literally within hours after this happened. Frankly, I think that's a potential re-traumatizing of these children right away. And there could be a range of opinion about that, but I think that's something that we have some irresponsibility out there in the competition for the latest breaking news that is so huge at this point. I think we want to get to, and again, I hope Dr. Newland will be able to join us to talk about how families cope and how we deal with this for our children. And I'll hold that, hoping that Liz can join us to talk a little bit about that. I do want to say a word about what's been pouring out in the news about the perpetrator, this young man, Adam Lanza, and what's being said about him. And I will repeat what I said earlier, that it's what impresses me so far is how little we do know that is confirmed. I think there are several things that are pretty persuasive that has been communicated, such as speaking to people who've been interviewed on the news who were schoolmates of his and direct acquaintances. And it's clear that he was a very isolated and disconnected young man who was intelligent, but at the same time had enormous interpersonal awkwardness and really was socially not in a sort of regular kind of social interactive circle. So that much I think is established, but what that means is unclear. You saw immediate sort of knee-jerk reports that this young man had Asperger's disorder. I don't know whether that's true or not. There have been some recent reports that may have confirmed that from information that may have been found from the investigation of the home. But if that's true, it does not mean that it's cause and effect. It doesn't mean that, in fact, one can assume anything about Asperger's itself being in the risk category. Autism spectrum disorder is a series of conditions that we know more and more about and we can help people with. And for me, one of the biggest concerns when we hear things like this is that it will reinforce the stigma that's out there already, which is pervasive and enormous. that if you have a mental illness, you are scary and potentially going to be harmful to others. In fact, the facts do not support that at all. There are enormous risk factors for violence that are enormously greater than mental illness itself. One of those is substance use, and that counts for a whole lot more. There are a very small group of patients who mostly have some risk factors when they're not treated and not responsive to the help that's available to them. And that's a very small group of patients. The MacArthur risk studies done some time ago, Jim, I know you had mentioned that in one of your emails, and I'm familiar to that in New York very much, indicated that people with serious mental illness, and an example being schizophrenia, may have some degree of higher risk, but it's more often a smaller group of that population who have a paranoid kind of orientation mentally and who have not been able to be engaged in treatment and are usually not, therefore, under control. And that's a very small group. So overall, it is not a high degree of risk. And in fact, some forms of mental illness have even been found to be protective factors that reduce the risk. So we have to be very careful not to reinforce a huge stigma that is an enormous problem for us at all times. How to then deal with a trauma like this at this magnitude is another part of what we hope we can think about. And I'm going to start sort of at this point not say more and ask John if he wants to say a little bit about it, because John's written the book on trauma and has had a lot of experience helping people who've experienced serious trauma. And maybe, John, you could say a little bit about that, and then, Jim, you might have questions. And if we don't have Liz join us by that time, we could open it for questions.
Yes, thanks, John. I'd be happy to make a couple of comments. Just taking off from what you just said, I think, you know, we do need to try to understand this, and of course it's frightening, actually, to try to comprehend the state of mind of Adam Lanza. It's something that we don't want to contemplate, but we do need to understand these events for the sake of prevention. And I would just underscore, it's tempting to seize on a single factor as an explanation, such as mental illness or violent video games or access to weapons, but thankfully, as horrific as this event is, it's extremely rare, and the presence of any single factor is not going to account for this. It's some kind of tragic combination of many factors that conspire, and of course the preventive efforts are going to have to be equally complex. With regard to the trauma, a couple of things strike me. First of all, as much as we mental health professionals might have to contribute, by far the most potent resource for prevention and healing is the power of families and friends and the community. And, you know, we see this again and again in the context of these horrific events. There's an unbelievably inspiring outpouring of caring, and that's really what's fundamentally needed to restore a sense of security and safety. The other thing we need to keep in mind is that trauma really refers to the lasting adverse consequences of exposure to these extreme stressors, and there's no doubt that this event is going to be life-changing for many, many people, but that's not to say that these lasting effects are going to include illness. What we do know is that most people who go through such events do not develop psychiatric illness, but also that we have very helpful treatments for those who do.
Okay, thanks, John. Jim, something you'd like to add, and also Perry?
We had a question before you started that I want to pass on, and we kind of addressed it. It concerned the rush to judgment that incidents such as this at Newtown and elsewhere across the country, that the perpetrators had a serious mental illness, and therefore mental illness was being very stigmatized. is violence stemming from that, which I think we've kind of addressed that that's not always the case. But the other part of the question was, is what things would you look for separate from mental illness if you were called upon to assess one of these people, and we'll just put Newtown out of the way because there's been a number of incidents. The assessment for the mental disorder is pretty straightforward. But if you came up negative there or only with pre-subclinical levels in several areas, what things would you, as experienced clinicians, look for then that might account for this? Video games, social isolation?
I just thought I should announce that I'm present. This is Dr. Newland.
Welcome.
I've joined you. Hi.
Hey, Liz. Thanks. John here. John Allen's on as well, and Perry Hoffman, and we have a group of listeners. Thanks for joining. I got an email from Liz that you may have had the time on the Eastern
I was on
the Central Time. So
I was on Texas time. Sorry about that.
Sorry about that. As I've already mentioned to people, Liz is director of our adolescent treatment program at the Menninger Clinic, and so glad you're on, Liz. And we just had one question that Jim Bruning just summarized for us.
Right.
That you heard, I think. John, you want to respond to that, and I'll be glad to as well.
Well, take it, John. What are your thoughts?
Well, the thing that I would start by saying is that we know of things that are risk factors or potential risk factors for violence, but it's important to include quickly that even though we know group phenomena that have been established to be correlated with risk of violent behavior, that we are not at a point where we can, with an individual person in the room, conclude with certainty that even if some of those risk factors are present, that this person is going to be someone who becomes violent. And you can say the very same kind of thing about suicide, where we know lots of risk factors, such as things that suicide runs in the family, there has been a previous attempt. There are many things on the list that can be potential contributors to risk of suicide, but that doesn't mean you can predict it well with an individual patient. We wish that were the case, and we hope our field, and I believe that it will mature to a point when our science, which is getting better and better every day, informs us with enough clarity that we can then, with an individual set of evaluations, perhaps brain imaging and other tests, detect who might really be individually at risk. So that would be very important way to sort of think about it to begin with. And then I would add that if you were trying to evaluate somebody, one thing that's very important is history. And so you want to know, has there been any history lifetime of violent behavior? If it's something that started early, even showing up as something that might have been identified as conduct disorder in childhood, and then later, if you see a pattern of law-breaking or criminal behavior or really what we call psychopathy, those are the kinds of things you would also look for as potential components of a person's makeup that might predispose toward behaving in a violent way without the kind of usual checks and social conscience and interpersonal empathy that is what the majority of people experience. John, Liz, you want to add things?
I might just make one point about this, John, that although it's not a sufficient condition, access to weapons is a necessary condition. And, this is one of the main things we think of with suicide as well. And, is the access to lethal means.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, of course, there's a huge debate raging at this point about what should happen with gun control. I think it's a complex matter. My personal opinion, I have no hesitation in saying it, is I think we need an enormously increased amount of gun control. I don't support the level of almost minimal gun control that we have now in this country. But I don't say that with any illusions that would immunize us from this kind of violence. I mean, it wouldn't have helped in this case because the mother had the permit. And frankly, in this particular situation, I think that's baffling. That with a presumably troubled young man, he would bring a collection of guns and take in on practice ranges. And what that does to me is raise a lot of questions. And the questions aren't just about the child, Adam, but about the mother and the whole situation, about which we know very little.
Right.
Did you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that earlier there was a mention of, you know, some questions about what are, you know, things that can put children at risk for this sort of behavior, and they asked about video games and violent behavior, and, you know, I don't think video games alone are sufficient for causing this sort of behavior, but if you have a child who has particular vulnerabilities, you know, I certainly think they offer a practice effect, a desensitizing effect, and could increase the risk for those children. So parents need to be sort of aware of what their kids are being exposed to on television and on video games. I mean, I certainly see these young people who are socially isolated and who are very much alone and who spend hours and hours immersed in violent video games. And I don't think we have randomized controlled trials that could prove it, but I think anyone who's in the military who uses these for training purposes would confirm for you that they offer some practice effect.
Right. Good. And the one thing I would just finally add in response to this particular question is that you really don't, you don't just look for a history of a kind of complete lack of a conscience, the kind of a history
right.
of being a bully, being conduct disorder, because there are other kinds of patterns that you also want to think about. For example, when I first was looking at this situation, to me, it's one thing to, in a kind of revenge, hatred, or rage, to assault, and sometimes this is indirect suicide or suicide by cop that you see in some of these situations. But I could not really easily make the leap from there to having young children as your victims. And to me, that puts it in the almost, if not potentially, frankly, psychotic category. That is such a break with reality. That it goes way beyond anything that you can do is even remotely rational.
Right.
And so then I would wonder, because sometimes you can see the sort of incubation of a potential paranoid psychosis, one of those conditions that's rare as a cause of violence, but it can happen. And it does sometimes become obvious and it becomes full-blown when you're in your late teens, early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So that immediately came to my mind as a thing to think about, at least, as well.
And I would say, too, that, I mean, we're talking a lot about what professionals can do to sort of try to identify the young people who are most at risk, but I would say a lot of the young people that are at risk for some sort of violence are not necessarily going to be in the office of a child psychiatrist or child psychologist, and that if you sort of take a step back, it's really the community around the child, that having a community that reaches out to the marginalized, the isolated, the obviously sort of lonely and angry child is so important. And if we can work to sort of create that sort of community around the child, I think that would go a long way as an intervention.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that is very important, because what we're really talking about here is prevention.
Right.
And so often, because of the stigma of mental illness, people don't talk about it. They feel ashamed of it. They hide it. They try to deny that it's real. They say, well, somebody's just a little odd, but that's kind of neat. And they don't really directly try to help people get help. and get evaluated, but that might lead them in a very much better direction.
And it's the kids who are having trouble connecting who are exactly the kids that we need to work the hardest to support and connect with. And unfortunately, I think often not only is it the parents that are fearful, perhaps, or who think that the child might be a poor influence and that sort of thing, but it's also sometimes, you know, school personnel don't know quite what to make of them.
Sure.
And that's where I think it becomes sort of a community issue.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, just asking you other questions.
Yes. Let me, people, let me get both of them, because they are kind of related mm-hmm. in a way. Parents, family members with a borderline member know to worry about suicide. That's a real risk that their borderline member will take their own life. But they also have ample experience of the walking on eggshells and the interpersonal aggression, sometimes physical threats toward them in this case. Should they be worried about their member killing someone?
I guess I would. My best answer to that is I think that it's not likely to be a high level of risk that family members should worry about. I don't mean that they don't have to be concerned about outbursts of rage and anger, because impulsive outbursts of anger and rage can be very common and sometimes can include some physical aggressiveness. But usually it's just a rage display rather than a calculated attempt to truly kill someone, which I think is generally very rare. And the one exception to that, when it might be something that one would want to be concerned about, is if there is three things together, borderline and antisocial personality disorder together, and on top of that, a pattern of substance use. So then you've got a cumulative, layered, intensified risk. One of the things that we know is that although people generally think of patients with borderline personality disorder as more often female, that's true in treatment populations. But if you do a door-to-door study, epidemiological data demonstrates that it's about equal between men and women. But men who are borderline frequently are also antisocial and land in the correctional system, as opposed to women who often have co-occurring other things, such as depression, and are very open to seeking treatment and are in clinical treatment settings. So that's the one kind of situation that might bear added risk. John, Liz, would you add?
Liz, go ahead.
John, you want to take this next?
Well, no, I would just underscore what John said about this incident, that this goes beyond, you know, typical psychiatric disorder. And I would agree with him that we're talking about a profound break with reality that's not at all characteristic of people with borderline disorder. This goes into a different realm, I think.
Right. Agreed.
Then the family member should feel distress at the experience of the affective oscillations and the anger and so forth, but not intimate fear of losing their life or that their member is going to go off and seriously injure or kill someone else. But what could... How they're concerned. How do I get the person into treatment or be engaged to pursue this when I'm going to get a flare back like this?
Right. So that's really a question about how to best be able to help your family member who is periodically having eruptions of rage and sometimes directed at you and not the least bit receptive necessarily to getting help or getting treatment. And that's a, it's not invariable. I guess the thing that I would just underscore there is that we've had a conditioned way in the past of kind of blaming the borderline patient and making it seem like this is done willfully and that they, if they wanted to, could really stop this kind of behavior. And we know a whole lot better now that that's just not correct. And when patients with borderline conditions have these rage attacks, they're really out of control.
John?
They've got a hyperactive emotionality, and they don't have brakes that work very well. And so they really can't turn it off. Yeah, hello.
Hi, this is just Don and Pandy. I wanted to tell you that I'm on.
Glad you're on, and welcome just to the listening audience. Let me just welcome Anand Pandya, who I mentioned might be able to join us. Anand, I'm on with John Allen here at Menninger, and also Liz Newland, head of our adolescent program. And Jim Breeling is on from NIMH, and Perry Hoffman. And we've got people listening and sending in questions, and we're delighted that you could join us. As I mentioned to others, Anand is from Los Angeles at UCLA and is a board member, a founding member, actually, of Disaster Psychiatry Outreach in New York. He and I worked together when we were both in New York and were there during the 9/11 tragedies. And he's very active in that whole area of how to help people respond to disasters. And we certainly, that is exactly the category we would put this Connecticut event, Sandy Hook event, in. So, and we were just now talking not so much about that, but about borderline patients who have kind of lost control.
Yeah.
So that's what I was saying about that. So I think we need to try to understand it. Liz, you're going to have?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something we certainly run into all the time with our adolescent patients who feel sort of coerced into treatment and are having difficulty engaging in treatment. And, you know, the one type of therapy that they usually come in not having had previously is family therapy. So if it's a family member and if it's appropriate, I think sometimes it can be helpful to offer to go with them. I mean, that's just a practical thing that, you know, it may be helpful to say, you know what, this is something we're in together, and it can be difficult to go to your first appointment, and maybe I'll get something out of going with you and try to sort of join with them about it to maybe make them feel a little bit less like the identified problem.
Right, and you could even extend that a bit. That's a great suggestion.
Yeah.
You might extend it a bit to say, you know, maybe we both need help. Maybe things I don't understand that I'm doing that I'm doing wrong and not able to help you. And so it would help me also to go. So you don't just say, I'll keep you company.
But we're in this.
And
I mean, of course, it depends. Yeah, how old the patient, you know, is and what your relationship is with them. But that's just sort of joining with them in it is one way to diffuse maybe their defensiveness. Because as Dr. Oldham was saying, they've probably spent a lot of time being sort of demonized for their outbursts. And they've probably lost a lot of relationships as a result of some of their difficulty in relationships. So.
Right.
Let me, two other things, and then we'll turn to the trauma side of it and family members. I'm trying to rephrase this in a general sense. Sounds terrific to help kids that are feeling isolated or having difficulties as they're growing up, but, you know, their important group is their peers, and that's even more true as adults. Here I'm getting old. My borderline child is a young adult. His and her world is with their peers, not with the future nursing home population. Kind of interesting expression there. But it's kind of true. You know, what can I, you know, I can certainly try to be helpful, but my child is really isolated, and I don't know, what can I do about that?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Oldham, did you want to try that?
No, you're right.
That's a tougher question, because once you get past organized school age, it is more difficult to connect with a peer group.
And John, jump in or amend anyone. What I was thinking about, and with respect to that, it's a very good question, because you know, a lot of times actually families and parents, as the years go by, become worried about this and are not able to foresee that they'll be able to stay in good health and be able to be there for the family members. One of the things that's been identified is, this is through the work of people like Mary Zanarini at McLean and John Gunderson also at McLean, in following patients with borderline personality disorder over time. And we've seen that it's really the good news part is that after, well, one study that was published, which is a really important study, showed that at 10 years, that the number of patients who are no longer meeting or even close to meeting the diagnostic threshold for borderline, all of whom were way above it when they started the study, is very high in this study. After about 10 years, about 85% of them are not at all close to the required threshold for the diagnosis. So these patients get better. And what they generally do is that they're able to get better with learning to avoid stressful situations and the kind of environment-precipitated, reactive, symptomatic behavior, such as the self-injurious behavior or the suicidality, calms down and no longer is seen very much. But level of social and occupational functioning doesn't improve as rapidly. That doesn't change that much. So it's that peer group social comfort, as well as confidence and ability to enter the employment world, those are not as quick to recover. And Gunderson has really shifted a lot of his interest and focus on trying to help really shape the treatment around this kind of peer support and psychosocial recovery model. So I think that's an important way to try to engage the patient. And there are more and more places where this can be helpful. There are peer-to-peer groups. And Perry, you know a fair amount about that, I'm sure. And Anand, you do as well, I imagine.
Yes.
Anand was the former president of the of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So you might want to comment as well.
Yeah. The majority of the support services, the peer support services that NAMI offer, are aimed more at people with psychotic spectrum disorders and major mood disorders that are often quite disabling. And so when a person has borderline personality disorder alone, I'm sometimes a little reluctant to refer them to a peer-to-peer class or a peer-to-peer support group, until I know that the local peer support groups have other high-functioning patients, or else that can be a big turnoff. Now, that being said, it's definitely more people with bipolar disorder than people with schizophrenia, and therefore there's which of course there's high rates of mood disorders with borderline personality disorder, so it may be a great match. NAMI's peer supports may be a great match, just it's worth checking out a little bit, and if you call the local NAMI affiliate, they'd probably be able to give you a sense of whether it's a good match or not.
I just wanted to say, in terms of peer resources, Diane Holt's been working very hard on putting things together for the BPD community and doing a lot of exciting things that hopefully will come to fruition in the next year. But it was helpful to hear that the NAMI groups really need to be screened to see if it's the right group for someone with BPD. In terms of families, we do our Family Connections class, which is a 12-week course, And what happens after that is that it spins off to these support groups that really are just all over the country, because once people get together and form a connection, they don't want to lose that connection. So I think, you know, hopefully there's some need being met on that level, but there's so much more work that does need to be done.
There's a question I want to get in this. Dr. Allen, I think you referred to people who tend to do these kind of things tend to have a major psychotic-like stage at the time. And could that be the sort of borderline that's on the border boundary between neuroticism and psychosis, kind of going over the hill? And a deep thing, and is psychosis generally a serious risk factor that accounts for a good deal of these kind of mass killings?
You know, I wish I knew the answer to that question, and I confess I don't. I'm just speculating about what it would take to engage in that kind of behavior that's so out of touch with humanity. And again, I think any particular disorder, there's going to be a very low risk of this kind of behavior simply because of its sheer rarity.
Yeah, I'm just reinforced that. I think that this is speculation still, even on our part, with regard to this situation. But if someone develops a break with reality and an emerging psychosis, that is, in fact, by itself, not necessarily a significant or certainly very strong risk factor, because this kind of violent behavior is very rare, and there are enormous numbers of people with very treatable psychotic conditions who, even before they get into treatment, they may develop a loss of reality testing, but they're not in the least bit dangerous or a risk with regard to violence. So it's so much the exception that it's not something that very often would pop up on my radar screen or on my computer as something to be that concerned about. As I say, it's only when you have this really, really embedded, paranoid, mistrustful, pretty pervasive break with reality, and the nature of the paranoia means you can't even trust the treatment system, and so you don't get the treatment. That, those kind of situations, you would want to at least try to evaluate the risk in the individual person.
Yeah. Our patients sometimes use the metaphor, it's very helpful, of a perfect storm, where you have a whole host of conditions coming together at a particular moment. And I think that's the way we need to think about it. Lots of factors, the psychiatric state being only one of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the MacArthur risk study, which followed up in the community, 900 people who were admitted to the psychiatric emergency room for short inpatient treatment. Looking at this prospectively for psychosis to violence, there was just no relationship at all, which is the right way to do it. Sometimes people have caught people at a psychotic state and looked back retrospectively and found a relationship. But if you do it the rigorous way going forward from the psychosis, you don't get anything.
That's an important point, Jim, right?
Yeah, that would be true of any single factor, I think.
It
same would be true of access to weapons. Prospectively, wouldn't predict anything. But coupled with a whole host of other things, then it becomes very significant.
Yeah, you start putting these things together. And actually, with the anger and with substance abuse, they found daily fluctuations, whether people in weekly fluctuations if we're using drugs or were having high rates of anger, you'd get daily correlation, weekly correlations with more violence or less, depending on what was going on. So that becomes encouraging, but as you point out, I think very rightfully, these things don't operate in isolation typically. Which makes it very challenging.
Right.
Turning to the NAMI experience, are there, should parents and support groups be giving this kind of mass killing something to discuss among themselves with their borderline or mentally ill family member, or just see if a question arises, or what?
The NAMI family-to-family course has already considerable material talking about parental concerns about violence, and I really can't emphasize enough that it is more useful to be thinking about violence in general rather than mass killing, trying to worry whether your child is going to engage in a mass killing. It is like worrying about, are we going to have a 9.0 earthquake when a 6.0 earthquake can do plenty of damage? So you want to kind of worry more about, are we going to have a bad outcome for any kind of violence? And so they have a lot of that information in the family-to-family course. I actually revised that those handouts recently to keep up with the latest studies. But one...
Still there, Anand?
Did we lose you? Oh, he'll jump back on then, I'm sure.
Okay, I think we lost you, Anand. I think we did. Well, I'll jump in and just see if he gets back on. But one thing I was just going to add about that is that I was interviewed by NBC here on Friday Friday of this event, and then also with the Houston Chronicle, and both groups asked me, what can you say to? Are you back, Anand?
Yep, I'm back.
Okay,
so I was just saying, I apologize about that. I could hear you, but obviously you couldn't hear me. So the last point I was just going to make about that is that the NAMI course does emphasize the value of, if you feel there's a question about violence, it's important to ask your relative directly, and that there's a large number of people who will talk about it if you ask, but you won't find out about it if you don't ask. So I think that's good advice.
Right. Well, that's a great point. It's actually just real close to the point I was going to make, that because I got asked by the media, what should parents do to help their kids? I said, first of all, you don't want to ignore it and act like nothing happened, but you also don't want to overexpose the kids. So you certainly don't want to park them in front of the TV and have them watching down the clock, because all that does is intensify the trauma. But, Liz, you might comment on this, because it is a delicate question that parents worry about, And one point that I make, not just about the kids in this example, but across the board, is that, and it's what I said earlier, if you have concerns and you know that, for example, this is all over the airwaves, all over the Internet, mm-hmm. and that all of the kids are going to be exposed to it, whether you think they are or not.
Right.
You're not saying anything about it. You want to bring it up. You want to sort of help them talk about it.
Right.
But you're the better expert there, Liz, so say anything about that.
Well, I mean, I think absolutely, even if you're one of the parents out there that, doesn't have a television at home, other children are going to talk about it with your child, because it's sort of, playground discussion at this point. It's such a story. I think it's important to ask what they've heard before you assume that they've heard everything. And, be willing to sit and hear their questions and be sort of prepared yourself, because you just have really no idea before you go and talk with your child what sort of questions they may bring to the table, and you want to be prepared, sort of as you were saying, to adjust what you're presenting to them based on their age. I mean, if they're 7 years old versus 14 years old, you're going to give them a very different level of information, and you don't have to tell them everything. I think that's, you want to be honest, but that doesn't mean you have to tell them all of the details of this horrific event. Because for smaller children, they can't process that. They don't have a framework for understanding it. I think probably one of the most important things is that you're also demonstrating for your child that even though this is a horrific thing that happened, that you feel that your child is safe to go to school and that you're handling this okay, even though it's very sad, because how you handle it is going to predict how they feel about going to school.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. The other thing I would add is that we often said after 9/11 in New York that people need to understand that when they're feeling stressed out, when they're feeling unable to sleep, when when they find themselves drinking too much, that and for the most part, these are what we call normal reactions to an abnormal situation. Mm-hmm. And there's a child counterpart to that. So, Liz, I'm sure you could see things that you'd want to watch for and not be surprised by. Things like a return of bedwetting or nightmares or things like that.
Right, absolutely. And certainly those are going to, I would expect that more for children who are kind of closer to the traumatic event. But it could happen in the more sensitive kids who just simply hear about it or are more sort of immersed in hearing about it. And so, I think it would be important to be on the lookout for some of those signs, whether it's more irritability or moodiness, more anxiety, or like you were describing, some of the behavioral problems.
Is there a generalization that's fair to make? And there may not be. If a parent asked you, well, how long should I assume this is still okay and what the normal reaction would be? And when should I worry that maybe this my child needs to get some help?
Right. I mean, I think I have a pretty low threshold for taking your child in to talk with someone. I mean, I think if the parent is feeling overwhelmed by their child's either disturbance in their mood or their behaviors, that's a reason to go and talk with someone. And if it's interfering with the child's normal functioning, that's always also a good sort of barometer. If they're not able to go to school, if they're not able to sort of pay attention in class and do their homework, and it's starting to cause a change in their grades or a change in their relationships with friends, or they're really withdrawn, I mean, that's, I think, a reason to get some support. Even if it is a more transient reaction, I think having an intervention early on could be potentially very helpful.
Yeah,
prevent it from continuing into something more serious.
Good. Jim, back to you.
What kind of intervention would you think about?
I mean, I think talking with a guidance counselor at school is a place to start if you're not sure where to go, and getting or your primary care doctor to get a sense of who's a good counselor to talk with. So a counselor could be a social worker, a psychologist, child psychologist, could be a family therapist. Unfortunately, in most places, there aren't enough people who are specifically trained in trauma work. And with children. I mean, those are two areas of expertise. So I think it's probably, I wouldn't go so far as to say you need to find a child trauma expert, because I think that the reality is that's not going to be available in most places. Start by going to people that you trust, people at your school or your primary care physician, and ask for a suggestion of who would be a good person for your family to talk with.
If the psychotic person during a psychotic state is not particularly aggressive toward others, are they self-directed aggression, like suicidal risk?
I would initially say to that, I just think that's hard to generalize about. I don't think that's inevitably going to be the case. It certainly can sometimes be, and suicide risk is significantly higher in numbers of groups of patients. That includes people with severe depression, but it also includes people with schizophrenia or bipolar illness. So these are all states that are accompanied by an elevated risk for suicide. So it can sometimes be something you do need to worry about. John, would you add to that?
But John, you're addressing me?
Yeah, I just wondered if you had anything you would want to add to that. That's my first thought.
Well, the only thing I would reiterate is the best way to find out is to ask. And that, you know, making assumptions, I think, is where we can go wrong. And very straightforward questions about what's on the person's mind, I think, is really the best way to assess this.
Right.
And if I may jump in, the way that question was asked, I was thinking that there was an assumption that there's X amount of aggression or tendency to be destructive, and if it's not directed outwards, it would be directed inwards, and that's not the case, obviously, and in fact, there's some evidence on the other extreme. People with patterns of chronic violence towards others have an increased rate of self-injury.
Right, good point. That's a good point. So they can go together, in other words.
The people with self-injury have a high rate of externalizing disorder symptoms, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then, with borderlines having a very, very high rate of self-injury,
mm-hmm.
We're talking a fair amount of acting out then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think most people who help try to work with borderline patients understand that is part of what one will often expect, and certainly families have that experience as well.
Just not at the level of serious assault and homicide.
Right. But, not to that level of risk that we're talking about that would even remotely come close to the situation in handicap.
We're getting close to, I hesitate to open up some of these other questions as we're running out down on time. Rather than doing that, if you had one thought, each of you, to people particularly to take away from this about from this general topic,
well,
what might it be?
Okay, I'll start and then we'll go around. My main thought is it's actually a two-part thought. One is don't believe everything you hear in the media, and get your facts and try to get them to the point where you really believe there's good evidence that confirms what you hear. And then number two is try to be as comfortable as you can be practicing ways to bring up with people who look troubled
mm-hmm.
and talk to them about it and say, pardon me if I'm overstepping here, but I'm feeling a little worried because you really seem to be struggling. Is there anything I can do to help? Are you getting some help about it? We need to get past being hesitant to raise questions. So those are my quick takeaways. John, what would you say?
What I would reiterate is the sheer rarity of these horrific events. That's not to say that we shouldn't do everything we can to try to prevent them and learn everything we can about it, but I love the point about the 9.0 earthquake
mm-hmm.
that we really should focus on the more ordinary problematic levels of this behavior. That's where our attention needs to lie.
Okay. Anand, would you add? We're losing an answer, Liz. What would your take-home point be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you and John have covered much of it. I mean, I think it's emphasizing the importance of curiosity and compassion for everyone, including those that are marginalized and maybe a little different.
Right. Good. And then I would just wrap that up by saying that we just need to help people understand that these are brain disorders. The brain is part of the body, just like the heart is and just like every other part is. If things can go wrong with it, we've got a whole lot of information and effectiveness in terms of how to help, how to treat it, and we just need to get people more comfortable understanding that it's all the same kind of thing, and psychiatry is part of the house of medicine, and our illnesses are biological illnesses that can be treated. So that's a little soapbox that I get on often.
I want to convey here from various people the appreciation for each of you giving your time and your experience and your knowledge and your wisdom and your compassion. Such a note here, such a contrast from the almost hysteria that can come across in the media, and also for the season, how well the concern to reach out and touch and care for other people fits in with the season of the year. I think each of you are doing a very special ministry of compassion and caring that's very important. So, Perry, do you have anything to add? I'm just, I think that's John, such a super team of people, and thank you so much for your own time and expertise in this.
Absolutely. I was delighted to do it, Jim, and also thanks to John and Liz and Anand for joining. I think we do make a good team.
And I want to just reinforce that and thank all of you for doing this and taking your time after a busy day and sharing, as Jim Breling said so well, in such calm and centered way, unlike what we've heard over the last week. So I think we all take... We take your take-home messages to heart. So thank you so much for doing this for us.
Okay, great.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night,
everybody.
Good night.
Good night.